three. It's hard to believe that my memory could be so vivid at that age. I always thought I was around four when my mother took me to see Fantasia, and the experience that I describe in the book, that I don't think I'm going to be reading that section. But it's kind of an interesting turn on the spiral that as I'm exploring the roots of pop mythologies as religious experiences and religion as fake religion and the contradictions in our American culture, where the fake reveals the authentic, invisible cultural transformation, and the authentic disguises the actual nature of the times we are in, which is the paradox I play around with through the book, which is, I guess, a kind of aletheia. But looking at that and seeing the turn of the spiral that I'm working on Fantasia right at this time, when I read the New York Times today and it says the videotape is out, and if you rush only for 30 days, you can get the videotape of Fantasia. I'm also thinking, as a cultural historian, of 20 years ago with At the Edge of History, and this, in a way, is kind of like a turn of the spiral. It's a sort of mind travelogue about pop American culture, and it's a very extroverted meditation. But even before it really came out, it already created a shitstorm in cyberspace, because friends were telling me that there was just furious rage from Stuart Brand and Howard Rheingold about this book, because I'm not celebrating virtual reality. And I thought it's kind of interesting, because Stuart and I were, you know, we're friends, and we're both, you know, fellows of the Lindisfarne Association. But there was a kind of little tempest in a teapot 20 years ago over At the Edge of History, when Stuart and I were finalists for the National Book Award, and it went to Stuart, and I think one can make a good case that the Whole Earth catalog certainly was much more part of the architecture of pop culture than At the Edge of History. But some of the New York culture types who were literary critics resigned from the board of judges in protest that literary prizes could go to a telephone directory. So it was really like a showdown between New York and California. And I was in this funny position as a kid from California. I grew up in L.A. I went to L.A. High. I graduated from Pomona College. Here I was explaining California to New York in their terms, literary essays, and they were getting interested in it, but that was creating a protest of protecting the literary essay from the infiltrations of California. So I thought I was on, you know, Stuart's side. But then when this turn of the spiral came up, and I was taking another look at sort of a dark comedy of errors in the Sun Belt of Orlando and Atlanta and the Tucson biosphere and a little bit of the north of the West Edmonton Mall, the largest shopping mall in the world, which all of this is part of my anthropology for this book. It was intriguing that in the debate that I only heard about from friends, because I'm not privy and privileged to this particular electronic bulletin board, my friend, the mathematician Ralph Abraham, said there are two cultures now. It's not C.P. Snow's two cultures, it's fax culture and modem culture. And I'm definitely fax culture, because it protects the integrity of the text. And literary writers and literary agents tend to use fax. And scientists tend to use modem, partly because the university pays their phone bill. And as a, you know, since I'm not a professor, I don't have Ethernet to pick up the bill or whatever, BitNet, I guess it's called. So part of this, the shitstorm that was going on in cyberspace, as Mary Catherine Bateson and Howard Rheingold and Stuart Brand and Francisco Varela in Paris, so this is like New Hampshire, Paris, California, all arguing with one another. And somebody from Shell Oil, I guess in the Shell Learning Group, who had made the mistake of saying, hey, I never read literary essays, but I've been reading this book, you know, and it's literary essays, but it's kind of interesting. And then all of a sudden, California rises up in revolt and said, and Howard Rheingold was quoted on the thing saying, the literary essay is not the right form in which to discuss new technologies. So I thought, now that's, as a cultural historian, that's fascinating to me, because here, 20 years ago, we were allowed to be sort of neck and neck for a literary prize, but now 20 years later, you're not even allowed to dare to permit yourself to think about the implications of the new technologies. And only memoes and American slang and sort of kind of apologetics that you see in Stuart's book on Inventing the Future at MIT, where he said, if you're not part of the steamroller, you're part of the road. Great line. Memorable prose. And the whole book is indeed a celebration of MIT with just like phallic fascination. Oh, you're so big, you fascinate me, you're wonderful. and not allowed to think about the shadow side of the medical side of to invoke Eylül or Illich or Heidegger or anybody, just celebration of modernism and all its great rewards and joys. And every technology has to be, of course, revolutionary. You know, you can't have a new technology without it being revolutionary. So it was kind of fascinating to me to see how we play this kind of bicoastal ping pong, that I was an MIT professor writing about California, and then Stuart Brand, you know, Silicon Valley, goes and writes about MIT, and we go back and forth. And yet the more we engage the culture, the more we enter into this catastrophe bifurcation where our sensibilities split. I wish Stuart were here tonight. So even in the very process of doing it, it sort of engages itself in the culture and generates anger, rage. And you always know something's good and something's real when people are getting angry. It's connected to guts and life and nerves and blood and everything else. So part of it is, I think, how I say it is as important as what I say. And part of this is an attempt to protect the integrity of the literary essay. All of the chapters of the book are named after the functions of the video recorder. So it's fast forward with a jeu de mots of both meanings of the word fast forward, play and record and erase. And it's an attempt on the part of the writer to return the favor. Electronics surrounded us and made us an artifact in their post-whatever culture. And I'm trying to return the favor. And yet the very effort to say the literary imagination is adequate and appropriate to discuss the implications of technology, there's a sense that this is a threat and that this is not the appropriate way. And the dictum coming out of Howard Rheingold, who's now the editor of the Whole Earth Review, is to say literature just has to disappear from the face of the earth, that only memoirs is the appropriate language for the imagination now. And I think that's really quite intriguing. And I'm Irish enough to say, fuck you, buddy. I'm not about to do it. But I wish to mythologize the fight and not to have it disappear in cyberspace, because I think it's so important and so interesting. And to argue in favor of Howard Rheingold's book on virtual reality, he went, ironically, to a lot of effort to be a cultural historian and to really research the roots of entertainment and Silicon Valley and all the origins of virtual reality and how it came to be. That said, I think what I'll do, what I want to say also with this, in terms of the turn of the spiral, is as I was coming up here, people saying, well, with nonfiction writers, it's a little different from fiction writers. And I was thinking, well, fiction, nonfiction, you know, this doesn't work anymore. And part of my whole career has been to try to create a kind of new genre of Wissenskunst, where the actual art of nonfiction, which is not alone to me, people, you know, Norman Mailer, Lewis Thomas, Castaneda, others have used this. But in this particular book, I'm also trying to blur the distinction between fiction and nonfiction, because it is a travelogue on the real, but the last conclusion of the book is actually a short story. And it's a short story that doesn't occur in real time, it all occurs in video monitors. So in that sense, I'm moving into agreeing with Stuart Brand and Howard Rheingold and going from reality to cyberspace. I thought what I'd do tonight is just, I was gonna read the fast forward, but I think that's so snarky and so swifty, and then you might think I'm very anti-American, and then I'd have to, you know, fight patriotism and, hey, you're just a Europhile putting down America, and that's not what I'm doing in the book. I thought I would go, since this is the 50th anniversary of the Disney stuff, I read a little section of the Disney chapter. It's hard because it's a long chapter. It's like 55 pages on the cultural implications of Disneyism, and I'm only going to read about 10 or 13. And that should take about 20, 25 minutes. And then the rest is open for questions or refutations or heresy trials or anything you want to do with me. Is that okay?
Great.
Okay, this is from the chapter called Play. Well, let me read you the title so you can get the structure of the book. Fast Forward, The American Replacement of Nature. Play, Disney's World, The American Replacement of Culture. Record, CNN, The American Replacement of Historical Reality. This is my essay on the war in the Gulf, watching it in my living room in Zurich. Erase, Gnostic Technologies, The American Replacement of Incarnation, which is sort of a critique of junk food and artificial intelligence, Hans Moravec's book on mind children. And Reverse, the study of the kind of nativistic movements of New Mexico. Everybody in Santa Fe is either a past life regression therapist or a shaman workshop director. So Santa Fe, Los Alamos is like chaos dynamics and the new science, and Santa Fe is sort of like nativism. And the intensity of America is really, what we used to be in California in like the 50s and 60s, it's now compressed into New Mexico. So I end reverse with the channels of New Mexico. The land of Chris Griscom and all of that. I spend a lot of time in the Southwest because the Lindisfarne Mountain Retreat is in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, which is in sort of over the border in southern Colorado. So this is from the Disney chapter, and I'll just come down in media res and not try to read too much. Drama, presented in the open space of the Greek theater, was a popular art form that brought the community together in the face-to-face manner that contributed to the open space of direct democracy in the Greek polis. In the shift from direct democracy to representational democracy, the printed book became an embodiment of thought for the physically absent author. And so the popular art form of the printed book and the pamphlet re-presented ideas and contributed to the public space of the political philosophies of the Enlightenment. Television, however, now brings forth this new kind of public space, and it calls into being this new world, not of the educated citizenry in a republic, but of the electro-peasantry in the state of entertainment. Recall how people stopped singing in pubs when they brought in the TV set, and you will appreciate the new passivity in which people stop voting for their representatives as TV takes over the electoral campaigns. Kindergarten teachers tell me that children no longer sing spontaneously, for they know that songs are what the famous sing on MTV. They hope someday to grow up to become Pepsi's Madonna, but in the meantime, the only songs for which they know the words are commercials. It is not all that far from a televised song to a televised election. The cultural implications of Epcot are that this non-community is a real polity, one that actually performs the transition from plutocracy to mediocracy, with an O, a society of the mediocre bonded together by the entertainment media. This new polity is one in which democracy, in quotes, becomes an artifact, an antique culture, in quotes, within a new society, not one of representation in a literate republic, but of fantasy participation in the electronic state. The citizen votes for someone who expresses his or her philosophy and represents it in Congress. The electro-peasant votes for someone he or she likes. It is not a question of mental reflection, but magical participation. Bush runs for president figured against a giant American flag, and Dukakis puts on a helmet and takes a ride in a tank. The technicians who demand that these photo opportunities be produced for public consumption are members of the same profession that created the American adventure at Epcot. Outside this pavilion, by the shore of the artificial lagoon, an African ensemble performs tribal music and dance. But a few yards away, closer to the entrance, a Dixieland band loudly drowns them out. America's never been very good at hearing the Third World, and although it enjoys ethnicity in restaurants, it tends to transform disturbingly complex black jazz into fun-loving white Dixieland music. Inside the pavilion, this system of taming the wild is carried further as that dirty old man, Benjamin Franklin, and that sarcastic old bastard, Mark Twain, are turned into ushers for a ritual in the civic religion of Disneyism. Franklin and Twain introduce us to another movie set experience of the spatialization of time, as all the presidents of American history are brought to life on stage in an audio animatronics display in the Hall of Presidents. The only other place in which they all could be together is heaven. So it is possible that some people do get a little disoriented in the dark of the theater. With a vision of all the presidents before them, the stirring music of fife and drum just becomes too much for many people, and they begin to weep in seizures of patriotism. Pay no mind to the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, for every image and soundbite is controlled by a bank of computers and a group of technicians that would make NASA proud. But that is no different from your average presidential campaign. There, too, a group of invisible technicians serves an equally invisible board of directors. What Disney prefigured, Reagan figured, as he became the first entirely audio animatronic president, a lovable creation that performed perfectly according to the programming of the technicians and the dictates of the board of directors. As to who serves on the board of directors of This America, I certainly have no way of knowing. Right-wing paranoids will tell you that it is the Rockefellers with their trilateral commission, but I doubt it. For that sounds much more like a projection of the right-wingers' own alienated way of working in secret military cells and survivalist colonies. The old rich of any society need no secret conspiracy, because the old boy networks within the ruling institutions have all the power that is needed to run a Great Britain or a United States. A presidential campaign, exactly like the Olympics, which also come every fourth year, is an electronic spectator sport. It is a spectacle for professionals who have trained themselves for this world of celebrity performances, of smiles, sound bites without substance or controversy, and stirring images. In this world of emotional signaling, it is more important to protect the flag than civil liberties. The flag is not a symbol of a revolution fought to achieve civil liberties from kings and cardinals. It is a symbol not of individuation, but collectivization, of the electro-peasant's bond to the body politic. If the flag is burned, then he or she is burned. Rational citizens, as children of the Enlightenment, will burn the flag to make a statement about constitutional rights. But electro-peasants will ignite in rage at their own disfigurement. The entertainment industry's reconstruction of American history and the American adventure is, when all is said and done, a dutiful exercise. After all, if history is not a text any longer, then history for the state of entertainment is motion picture history. Memories are not of historical events, they are recollections of past movies. Recall that President Reagan wept on several occasions on recalling his old World War II days. And remember that he was not recalling his own experiences of historical events, such as Omaha Beach or Iwo Jima. He was remembering the old war movies he had seen or played in. If you can understand the sensibility of President Reagan, then you can enter into this new kind of political virtual reality to appreciate why the designers of MGM Studios' theme park would try to recapture, quote, major moments in motion picture history, and why Cable News Network presents The Hollywood Minute and This Week in Showbiz. For the historyless people of this post-literate generation, it makes no sense to take them through the American adventure, for these people have not read Benjamin Franklin or Mark Twain. But if you take them on the Indiana Jones ride in the Disney MGM Studios theme park, now that is different. For the hat and the whip are icons, and the people will thrill to the joy of remembering the movie. In the old rides in Disneyland, the Pirates of the Caribbean and Haunted Mansion, it was the distancing of evil that was the setting up of space. Safe in one's bark, one could glide by the scenes of the pirates burning the town and carrying off the women. In the new Disney MGM Studios theme park near Disney World, the structure is the setting up of time as a manufactured horizon, a fake artifact of the past, not a personal past or a national history, but a memory of a movie you have seen. It used to be, you've read the book, now thrill to the movie. Now it is, you've seen the movie, now thrill to the ride. Lucas and Spielberg are men of my generation, of the 50s in L.A. As children of McLuhan's Global Village, they did not need to read McLuhan to understand that when a cliché is repeated or used as the model for a new performance, the cliché becomes an archetype. So old World War II movies like Air Force become the models for Star Wars. When a cliché becomes an archetype, old movies become myths. They become horizons that add the dimensions of the past to the present. Since Raiders of the Lost Ark is a copy of a movie serial, which is a copy of a comic book, an illusionary depth to time, a manufactured tradition, is created in which copy copies copy. What is important is not that this is all fake, for the content is irrelevant. It is the horizontal structure of the experience that is important. And that structure is one of magnifying and extending time to provide for people doomed to the shallow present of an electronic media society a substitute for a historical consciousness. You feel nostalgic for a past, and it doesn't matter if those tilted DC-3s and Bogey walking away with Claude Rains and the tarmac is not really your experiential past. After all, what is experience in an electronic society? The important thing is that those images are in your memory as images of the past, for that makes them part of your experience. It's all the same past for kids for whom Humphrey Bogart playing African sailor or Chicago gangster, or Carlton Heston playing Moses, God, or Michelangelo are all old folks back there in time with George Washington, the Beatles, Louis Armstrong, and Babe Ruth. If you grew up with 50 channels on your TV set or HyperCard stacks in your personal computer, then the past is not a text that moves from left to right with everything dated in a linear fashion from BC to AD. For post-historic Los Angeles, as Nathaniel West pointed out long ago in his novel, The Day of the Locust, history becomes a movie set that spatializes time. On one studio lot, you have Caesar and Cleopatra, while next to it, the Sioux are defeating Custer. For the young raised on electronic media, there is no historical past. There is only an eternal present in which all time is going on now. The narrative through which you construct events into a world is not a narrative of personal history, but a pastiche of lifestyles. Lifestyles are expressed in costumes that are a patchwork of signs purchased in a boutique. Furniture for the young is not an artifact of a king, a Louis XIV, but a poster of a celebrity, a Coca-Cola waste paper basket, a mobile gas pump light, and a war surplus inflatable life raft bed. These signs, whether they are worn around as furniture or on as clothes, have a recognizable nostalgic feeling to them, but no real history. In the costume as lifestyle, you don't become your own movie, as you might have done in the generation of the Depression. You become your own music video. In the former, you have an identity that unfolds its story, but in the latter, you have a collage that flashes its momentary mood and passing style. One of the reasons our generation got so caught up in Joseph Campbell and the monomythic pattern of separation, initiation, and return is for the generation over 35, we are immigrants to this new foreign world, and we hungered for myth and structure and meaning and an identity that unfolded itself through suffering and purgation and final illumination. But we're on the other side of this, you know, this great divide, and that kind of mythic structure is precisely what the music video culture is not. So Joseph Campbell was an antique as soon as Bill Moyers canonized him. These children of Sesame Street and MTV will not grow up to become responsible citizens with a highly developed sense of civic duty, but they will express a highly magical sense of global participation in sound that allows the skin of their own bodies to become the vibrating tympanum of a new collective entity. In fact, this is precisely why the young like to have their music loud. If you go into a bar that is a body shop for the young, it is not a pub in which you can have a conversation. It is a space in which all the bodies are kneaded into shape by physically palpable, extremely loud noise. You don't go there to exchange ideas, but to drum your edge, to feel the beat and the pulse in which you become part of the scene. Like motile spirochetes that billions of years ago attached themselves to large and sluggish cells in the evolution of bacteria, this noisy critter made up out of people is a piece of connectionist architecture that is headed for forms of life we old folks can hardly imagine. A person of my generation simply cannot stand to be in these spaces for even a few moments. Just as noise in public spaces takes away the silence necessary for mature and knowledgeable reflection, so does our entire invisible environment of electronic noise, from microwave to ELF, extremely low frequency radiation from transmission cables, wires, and video display terminals, take away the biological autonomy of the etheric membrane of the individual. The ultimate development in this direction is not a ride in the dark in Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean, but an immersion into cyberspace in which one's own etheric body is pirated by the electronic noise of a full body suit immersion into virtual reality. The full body suit is a technological literalization of the esoteric subtle body or etheric body, the pranamaya kosa of yoga and Tibetan Buddhism. This envelope of the subtle body is also the point of focus in Chinese acupuncture and in the martial arts such as kung fu. By interfering with its functioning and by appropriating it in a literalization that imitates but degrades its esoteric functioning, the individual is shifted away from the autonomy of its own membrane in its incarnation toward a collective incarnation. To understand this shift, one has to read cyberpunk fiction or the works of Rudolf Steiner, who predicted this state of cultural evolution and called it the emanation of Ahriman. Unfortunately, this reference to Steiner will probably upset students of cognitive science, especially my son. But they should ask themselves why practitioners of artificial life in software worlds often get the feeling that if there are worlds below them, then there could well be worlds above them, cognitive domains that exist in multidimensionality. William Gibson, the leading practitioner of cyberpunk science fiction and the writer who coined the term cyberspace, is clearly fascinated with the nature of evil as the new landscape of electronic technology. And in his novel, Count Zero, he has crossed voodoo with artificial intelligence. The cognitive scientist who is willing to take in voodoo should not be so quick to throw out Steiner. For thinkers as subtle and gifted as England's Owen Barfield, Germany's Joseph Beuys, and America's Saul Bellow have been fascinated with Steiner's philosophy. There is something to it, and if one wishes to understand the new electronic landscape that dematerializes our old worldview, then one can learn from Steiner without fear of having to enroll in his anthroposophical movement. Rudolf Steiner was an intellectual mystic whose philosophical movement through the normal Weberian process of the routinization of charisma has now become a somewhat rigid and humorless cult. Therefore, one can argue that if religion ends up in deception and distances itself from the original vision, it might be more true to the spirit to begin with deception itself in the realms of art and entertainment in order to constellate a disguised congregation sharing an unconscious cosmology. In his 1940 film, Fantasia, which has recently been re-released in 1990 to celebrate its 50th birthday, Disney reintroduced the animistic cosmology in which the fairies and the elves embody the seasonal powers of nature. By constellating a congregation through fun and entertainment, Disney was also able to use his films and his public following to amass the capital needed to found his electronic polity of Disneyland and Disney World. Science fiction writers and computer game hackers have continued this evolutionary crossing of pre-industrial animism and post-industrial capitalism by reintroducing the world of sorcery and the great battle between good and evil, between black and white magic into their software. All these different types of minds have reintroduced animism because the conventional worldview of materialism is not subtle enough to deal with the complexities of a multidimensional universe in which domains interpenetrate and are enfolded in one another in a non-Euclidean manner. Werner Vinge explained the fascination in his story True Names, which in 1979 was one of the first science fiction ventures into cyberspace, quoting Vinge. Mr. Slippery had often speculated just how the simple notion of using high-resolution EEGs as input-output devices had caused the development of the, quote, magical world representation of data space. The Limey and Erythrina argued that sprites, reincarnation, spells, and castles were the natural tools here, more natural than the atomistic 20th century notions of data structures, programs, files, and communications protocols. It was, they argued, just more convenient for the mind to use the global ideas of magic as the tokens to manipulate the new environment, end quote. Ever since I saw Fantasia as a child of 4 or 5, I have resisted Roman Catholicism and remained a Celtic animist at heart, and have known from the trance states I experienced from listening to classical music that the conventional religious and materialistic worldview of my society was inadequate. Over the years, the encounter with other philosophies and esoteric schools of contemplative practice, such as yoga and Buddhism, given me ancient maps for the new world I had entered as a child. Not through jacking into cyberspace on William Gibson's laptop Ono Sendai, but through Bach, Beethoven, and Stravinsky. What the Buddhist discovers in meditation is that there is no absolute discrete self, but there are infinite relations in all directions that are instrumental in bringing forth beings that pass together. Compassion equals passing together in concerts of time and space. The enlightened being travels more lightly than the heavy ego burdened with the matter of his or her afflictions. And the enlightened being can easily offer its music in concert with others to experience mystical states of union with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, angels and gods, or a vast and universal form of Godhead beyond the personifications of deities. The being that cannot open itself to these multiple dimensions chooses not to create its destiny, but to have its fate inflicted upon it in the samsaric form of suffering and evil. Notice how in our technological culture we can enthusiastically embrace Gibson's cyberpunk visions of voodoo and evil far more readily than we can Steiner's theosophical visions of angels and grace. In literature, dystopias are always far more compelling than vapid clerical visions of heavenly virtue. Gibson's work is enthralling because he understands as a writer that evil is the enunciation of a newly emerging level of societal organization. But if one truly wishes to understand the landscape of electronic noise in which the individual etheric body is so assaulted that an individual soul can no longer incarnate in a human body, then one has to read Steiner. The Mondo 2000 magazine enthusiast and apologist for the new technology of neuroreceptor drugs and full-body suit immersions into virtual reality will never discuss the side effects. So what needs Rudolf Steiner to balance the hype of the California snake oil salesman of drugs and computers? In the 60s, LSD externalized the collective unconscious, the astral plane, albeit in a kitsch and degraded form. This appropriation of the astral plane into the public space is now being followed up by the appropriation of the etheric plane. As psychedelic drugs combine with the effects of the invisible environment of drugs and foods and the polluted biosphere, the cumulative effect will be to erode organic autonomy and lower fertility rates. This has already begun to happen. And this will stimulate meta-business to compete with agribusiness. Just as America appropriated the family farm into feedlots and factories, so will it appropriate the family into the laboratory. Thus, the appropriation of the astral body in the 60s through LSD and the appropriation of the etheric body in the 90s will pave the way for the final act of the appropriation of the physical body around the turn of the century. Thus, America, the land of rugged individualism, will become the land of ragged individuals. First economically, with the homeless in New York where I live, and then physiologically. Through genetic engineering, in vitro insemination, and reproductive technologies yet to come, the individual will be so contained that incarnation will be captured in engines of procreation. Technologies will become ensouled, just as souls become denatured and shifted into collective lattices rather than into the animal hominid bodies of old evolutionary times. Quote, demons will be able to take human form and souls will be able to dwell in cognitive lattices, so that it is small wonder that today's science fiction landscape of novels and computer games is filled with mythologies of Dungeons and Dragons, monsters and devils. This paranoia is crazy, but the caricatured sketch reveals an isomorphism to an evolutionary metanoia that is beyond anything we could call normal. One can clue into this phenomenon of cultural evolution through the paranoid caricatures of the fundamentalists, who curiously seem to object to the Luciferic New Ages more than the Ahrimanic technologists in computer science. Or one can clue into it through cyberpunk fiction. Or one can get more than a clue if one reads Steiner and realizes that what one is looking at in the new electronic America so celebrated and hyped by Stuart Brand and Howard Rheingold is a collectivization that can be mythologically identified as the incarnation of the demon Ahriman. When life evolved, molecules were enclosed within the membrane of the cell. When mind evolved, cells were enclosed within the membrane of an individual organism. Now a planetary entity is evolving, and individual minds are being enclosed within a planetary lattice. New Age folks see it as a bodhisattvic ideal of empathy for all sentient beings, from whales and dolphins in the sea to starving nomads in the Sahel. Skinheads feel it as the power of the collective as they stomp in a rock concert or murder and rampage around soccer matches. Scientific folk feel it as they race to replace minds with planetary lattices of fifth-generation computers or package nature in Biosphere 2 in preparation for its export to Mars. And I'll stop there and we can question and argue. Yes, sir.
The astral body and the etheric body. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the technical terms in Sanskrit are the manomayakosa was the food body, which would be basically you know, what we would conventionally call the body, and then stop, but they keep going. And then there's the pranamaya kosha, which is the etheric body or the subtle body, and this is the what would be called qi in acupuncture, or building up qi in kung fu or the martial arts, where a certain kind of almost electrical energy that athletes feel, or dancers. Michael Murphy here in San Rafael is publishing, I think next spring, a 800-page book on the cities and the future of the body, in which he does the cultural history and the research into dancers and ballerinas and athletes and saints and ecstatics with the stigmata, and researches this whole area of the subtle body. And then I think that the Sanskrit for the astral body, which would be psyche or anima or the collective unconscious, is it Vijnanamaya Kosha? I've almost forgotten. And then the higher mental, and then the causal body. So there are conventionally five. Oftentimes, the way these are rendered in pop culture, if you saw the movie Baron Munchausen, each of the figures that surround the Baron have some of the characteristics of one of the subtle bodies. Or in Japanese puppetry, if you've ever seen a bunraku play, you'll see a puppet, but then there'll be hooded figures manipulating the puppet. This is the esoteric dimension of the subtle bodies that activate the visible ego, but it doesn't end there in these esoteric traditions. So physical, etheric, astral, mental, causal. Those are the theosophical translations of the Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I wonder if almost total omission, you feel that the etheric body of the earth is so totally overwhelmed by the products of human beings.
Well, there are some people who say that there's a certain frequency that the nervous system operates on, hertz, and that in conditions of silence you can actually hear the sort of pulse. If you go into meditation temples, oftentimes you can hear a kind of high frequency sound that's very characteristic of places where there's a lot of practice going on. And so if you go into places of deep solitude, for example, we built this meditation chapel at 8,500 feet up in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. So that kind of thing is what's missing. You know, Ivan Illich said that silence is commons, and now we're losing the commons. And so the quality in which those experiences are no longer available is part of, I think, this kind of collective phenomenon where noise is considered part of the collectivization that brings us together and makes the individual no longer the focus of incarnation. So it's much more shifting things into collective patterns or collective. And of course, if you're a Buddhist and you look at what is the self anyway, I mean, you can't be an individual without a language or without parents. And so what brings us forth as, quote, an individual is the collectivity. But now society is changing the nature of what would be considered the collectivity. But the kind of silence, I think for this other generation, silence isn't considered positive. It's considered an oral darkness. And so you have Muzak in elevators and Muzak in shopping malls, and you're never allowed to have silence, because that's really kind of ontological angst, because you have to confront this hollowness at the core, or you'll make noise and you'll start snapping your fingers or whistling in the dark or do something to avoid this other experience. Whereas in contemplative practice, you're forced to, you know, listen and hear this other, as Keats would call it, unheard music. Yes, sir.
Could you expand your point on paranoia and metanoia? I heard you to say, I want to see if this is so, that blood is flowering of technology is a paranoid attempt to simulate a metanoia.
No, I was saying that the fundamentalists who attack the technologies or the New Ages oftentimes generate paranoid narratives. And that paranoia and metanoia are isomorphic but not identical, and that if you want to really understand a culture and its complexity, you can't study it with academic specialization, but you have to take in everything from what the paranoids are saying, what pornography is saying, and body language and all of this. And then sometimes you see in the mad narratives of the paranoid a kind of crazy poetry that captures the invisible environment. So things like science fiction and Terminator 2 and the dissolution of the body, I think, are profound descriptions. And I'd take it all the way back to the emergence of television and early science fiction, like the invasion of the body snatchers and invasions from outer space. When we became aliens to our own world and immigrants to a new world, all our mythologies were of invasion from outer space. But I think this is a Feuerbachian projection outward of something much more subtle that was going on. And so I find in paranoid narratives something that's really important that I, as a cultural historian, can't dismiss as just crazy. But I can't take them literally either and say, yeah, that's the truth. And so when I moved from New York to Colorado, I was surrounded by fundamentalist right-wing survivalist communities. I'd been living in New York and was told this is a dangerous place, but when I moved to this village of 45 people, they had bazookas in their pickup trucks and were, you know, constantly threatening to burn us out because we were alien, I really discovered a much more dangerous environment than anything I ever encountered in New York. And their whole explanations of reality were just totally paranoid. The Rockefellers were going to start a nuclear war, they were going to blow up the planet, and their headquarters were going to be Crestone, Colorado, and I was a dupe and conspiracy of the Trilateral Commission, and all the, just got this wild stuff. And so I was just fascinated. And when I quit the university and exposed myself to the edge of the counterculture and the alternative movement, I lost the kind of MIT filter that kept the paranoids outside of my office. And so they came in by droves. And I learned an awful lot from just listening to their narratives as a description of what's going on. I remember one 16-year-old kid who came to me and talked for an hour and a half about he had been born to teach humanity how to have the proper bowel movement. And he went on for an hour and a half about how to have the proper bowel movement. And I thought, yeah, this is the problem of our culture with dioxin and plutonium. We don't know what to do with our shit. And this kid is a 16-year-old dealing with this central problem of elimination. And so ever since then, I've been fascinated. Now, sometimes paranoid books get published. I won't mention any names so I don't get sued. But there are a few out there. But I think they're still, you know, worth reading. But my attempt is to use paranoia as information, like comic books or Steiner or mysticism. Everything is grist for my mill. But I would hope that I'm operating at a metanoic level of using all of this more socially responsible form of discourse, I hope. Oh gosh, there's so many. You were patient.
In 1976, I did a double blind controlled study on the Bach flower essences. In 79, developed a new way of prescribing them using Yi Ching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw on page 128 of your book, you discussed the importance from the science fiction appreciates the unexpected, whereas other world use tends to reduce it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could extrapolate how the role of synchronicity would be affecting global transformation, and who are the people you respect and esteem that are doing work in synchronicity now?
Well, I don't know much beyond the original work of, Dirac and Jung, Carl Jung. The Bach flower remedies, one of the things I discussed for them is that it was interesting to me in living in Switzerland that they're available in regular conventional, quote, normal drugstores, and that the polarization that I had experienced in America between the AMA and quackery was not the case in Switzerland. And then when I looked into it, I found that they still affirmed the tradition that they would call Paracelsian medicine and went back to their own cultural roots, that Paracelsus was a doctor in Basel, and it's possible to be a homeopathic doctor and still have an MD from the University of Zurich. In America, I think when you get sick, you lose your civil liberties. And so this other tradition fascinated me. I think synchronicity is a way of doing what I was talking about in paranoia, that if you have a blinders on and you're only, you structure your narrative investigation, you say, this is my area of research, these are the questions I'm going to ask, this is what I'm looking for. Your answers are determined by your question. But if suddenly something happens out there that is not what you're looking for, but at the unconscious level is the deep answer to your program, then that's a kind of synchronicity. So this is like Kay Cooley in the Benzene Ring, or in the Gaia 2 book, wherever I talk about this going on with Varela's dream on cognitive bliss that he had at one of our scientific conferences. So that kind of synchronicity is where you precipitate into the environment the results of your questioning, but your imaginative connections are beyond the scope of your rational mind, and so it has to come at you as that which is other, the external. If you were much more supple and imaginative, the artist or the mystic, it would not necessarily be experienced as otherness. It might be much more part of the imaginative exploration. In schools, we're not taught to think this way, and so we tend to slice things up, and therefore we need synchronicity to deliver us. Yes?
Thyroid is your psychic center.
It's part of it. I mean, that's the physical base of the psyche, but it's not the only thing. It's involved, but it's not, you can't, in other words, you can't causally locate it. That's too linear and reductionist. It's involved, but it's much more complicated.
Can you restate that statement?
She said the thyroid is your psychic center. And I'm just saying it's not a one-to-one correspondence. It's you know, it's like if you're making bread and you're folding in raisins into the dough and you fold it up and you make braids, the subtle bodies enfold in and out of one another. So the thyroid is not one-to-one the explanation of the psyche. That's all I'm saying. It's not causal and linear. Does that make any sense, or is that too flip?
What kind of problem did you have with it?
So just cancer. I mean, as a kid, I used to get up and see the sky light up with the atom bombs. You know, and there, I think it was Bernard Glass did a study of, you know, it's like Chernobyl, did a distribution study of the waves of the open-air testing of the atom bombs in the 50s, and the incidence of cancer of the thyroid along the southwest were much higher than would be normally expected. So when I got up at L.A. and looked at the sky light up from the atom bomb test in Las Vegas, I was, you know, close enough to be involved in it. So it takes no, long, elaborate explanation to figure it out. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, let's go way back.
You mentioned Lindisfarne, did you?
Lindisfarne, yeah. I used to be a professor, and then inspired by Ivan Illich and the whole gone are the days of the alternative movement of the counterfoil institution, I quit the university and set up Lindisfarne as another way to live the humanities in a technological society. I tried to do it at MIT, but MIT was more interested in the Vietnam War days of behavioral science and control, and not bringing science and mysticism, you know, and art, science, and religion together. So I quit and set up Lindisfarne in 72 in New York. And so it's a kind of distributive lattice of artists, scientists, philosophers, astronauts, Zen monks, sisters, Benedictine monks, about 47 of us architects. And we come together and work on various projects. This is one of the projects, and Gaia 2 was another one we did in Italy. Last week, the Spanish architect, Santiago Calatrava, who's a Lindisfarne fellow, and Ralph Abraham, the mathematician, and Varela, the neuroscientist, and Lynn Margulis, the microbiologist, we all came together to work on designing a bioshelter for the top of St. John the Divine, the cathedral in New York, and it's going to bring together art, science, and religion, and electronic stained glass, and all kinds of stuff that, you know, doesn't exist yet. So it's a way of collaborating that I just found difficult to do in the university. So we have a center in New York, which is the cathedral of St. John the Divine, and then we have the opposite, a mirror opposite in a Zen monastery in the Sangre de Cristo, where we have a kind of Lindisfarne mountain retreat. And the Zen monks take care of that place. I founded it and set it up in 79 and then gave it to the Zen monks. And so we alternate between those two. But we're not a location, we're a lattice, you know, in that sense, those cog's eye. Yes, sir, way in the back. Those are sunglasses, yes.
About paranoid schizophrenics, bowel movements, cosmic myths. I know you like this person, so I want to quote. But love has pitched his mansion in the house of excrement. Nothing can be sold nor whole.
Which has not been rent.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
think that sums it all up.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's close to what our Artie Lang was trying to say in the 60s, that the psychotic, I think he went too far to one extreme of making the schizophrenic a culture hero. But the whole notion that that out of the rupture of the psyche can come, you know, sensitivity and awareness is certainly something I wouldn't disagree. And Yeats, the, you know, whom you're quoting, celebrates Crazy Jane, and so he has very much the mad tinkers, and it's very Irish. Yeah.
You criticize the New Age, and there are many ways you can say it, but I think one of the primary ways you can say it is the way you've been saying it and the way Yeats said it, because I see, and I'd like you comment on this. I see the main problem with the New Age is not being able to look at the dark side and not being able to see that nothing can be whole unless it is rent.
Yeah. No, I.
The terrible vision for them, and that's exactly in the last place they think of looking, where they have to look to complete their spirituality.
Yeah. No, I think this is true. And at one level, before the New Age got merchandised in the 80s in the Reagan era, I guess have been not uncomfortable being called New Age, because I would think of Goethe and Steiner and Nicholas Roerich and W.B. Yeats and William Blake and Freemasonry and Mozart and the Magic Flute. And I think that all is the architecture of the New Age movement, which is part of a political liberation movement of kind of the individual and the Protestant Reformation against king and cardinal and the ultramontane powers of the Counter-Reformation. And so politically, I would identify with that. But then in the 80s, it just got so hyped and so sold and Purple Crystals and Shirley MacLaine on the cover of Time that it became aesthetically repellent to me. So I split and went off and was working with Varela on Buddhism and neuroscience and my son and working on this book that they just published called The Embodied Mind, Cognitive Science and Human Experience. But at another level, yeah, I think David Spangler and I did a talk book from some sort of summer Chautauquas we did up in the Pacific Northwest on the critique of the New Age called The Reimagination of the World. And there's a long kind of feeling of how I feel about it and how he feels about it and the rest of the world. Yes?
I'm a little tired, so this might not make sense, but it seems to me that deconstruction ought to be critiqued as well, as it too is a conspiracy against literacy.
I think so, in the sense that again, in Imaginary Landscape, I talk about Roland Barthes, the death of the author, and the whole problem of trying to eliminate the authorial voice. That, for me, in the sociology of knowledge, this was when the Romantic artist. The viability, economic viability of the artist was ending. You know, I think perhaps maybe Thomas Mann was the last artist to be able to live off his royalties. And then there came the generation of professors of English literature who were salaried by the state. And as they rose to power, you got a rationalization of their power with a celebration of criticism as being more important than art. And so you got the, and this was the 60s, and this was right at the time of Roland Barthes. And I have a lot of problems with that, and I certainly don't like deconstructionism in architecture. I think it's really decadent and just a very shallow kind of trend. But it became much more an academic cult. The argument I make on Disney is that while the academics were retreating into sort of semiotic and deconstructionist cults, Disneyism, which would be held in contempt, was actually externalizing and spreading around the world from Tokyo to even to Paris. Now that's fascinating in itself, because Jack Lang, when he became Minister of Culture under Mitterrand, started his whole thing as attacking the Americanization of the planet and its vulgarity. He ended up welcoming Disney World because it's the largest investment in the history of France, the largest infusion of foreign capital. And it's the real secret of the Gulf War, because Attali and all the others were saying, look, Germany is going to take the northern route and reintegrate the Baltics and maybe even Russia into the new northern economic power. What are we French going to do? We've got to go for the sources of energy and make the Islamic underbelly the passionate body, but the brain will be in Paris. And so they had this whole thing of selling Mirage and nuclear technologies to Saddam Hussein. And the whole notion was to create Le Centre du Monde Arabe. They built that palace right in Paris. But so that was their policy. And then they found in the war that here Bush and Major were doing their thing, France was getting left out, and they had to choose between the American investment with Disneyland or trying to sell to Saddam Hussein. They junked their foreign policy, got rid of their Minister of Defense, and ran after Major and Bush and changed their foreign policy, overnight. So Disneyland, trivial, irrelevant, is actually not, But if you asked a professor of literature, why Disneyism is beneath contempt. It's not serious. But as a civic religion, this is why I argue it's a kind of variant of Mormonism. It really is a 20th century version continuation of Mormonism. It's a civic religion. So it has to be taken seriously. Part of this, the way in which the book, what it does is as important as what it says, is on the one hand, you have the California extreme of the memo and slang and sort of Howard Rheingold's statement that literary essays are not the appropriate means for discussing new and revolutionary technologies. On the other extreme, in Europe, you have Habermas and Derrida, who, from my Irish-American point of view, are almost unreadable. Now, what I'm trying to do, somewhere in the middle of those, maybe that's why I'm in New York, and I'm trying to relate my California youth and my, European middle age into some synthesis. This is an attempt to write serious philosophy that's funny, you know, that is just witty and accessible and about things, because the basic trope of European philosophy is to be inaccessible, to be incomprehensible, to make you feel stupid so that it empowers the professor or the critic. And I just say no, I'm not going to do that. I give you one chance, I'll give someone else a chance.
Some of our lifetimes, I remember the old argument C.P. Hill brought up. But when he was talking about the two cultures, he was talking about the literary culture and the scientific culture. Have you given any thought now, beyond the technological one, what about the scientific culture?
You know, I think that's a very good question. Actually, John Brockman, who's a literary agent who runs a thing called the Reality Club in New York, is writing a book about that very issue that you're describing. And he basically says literary culture died and that the scientists just, you know, went directly to the public, like Lewis Thomas or Stephen Jay Gould or popularizers. Whenever there's a scientific cover article in Time magazine, it sells twice as many copies as, say, a cover article on politics. So he thinks this is because people are more empirical, and I said, no, not the case. The scientists are mythologists for our culture. They're asking big questions, and they're giving big answers of who we are, where we come from, where we're going. So they're the myth makers of our time, and that's why they carry on a kind of bardic function. What happened to me when I quit the university is most of my colleagues actually in Lindisfarne are scientists. They're people like the neuroscientist Francisco Varela, the bacteriologist Lynn Margulis, the atmospheric chemist Jim Lovelock. So all of these people come together and we share a kind of sense of planetary dynamics. There's a sense of the bacterial bioplasm with Lynn, the atmosphere in Gaia with Jim Lovelock, the immune system with Varela. And though there are poets in Lindisfarne like Gary Snyder, Wendell Berry, Kathleen Rain, but the actual reimagination of the world for me is more coming from my scientific colleagues than my poetic colleagues. So most of the time when I'm talking to Wendell, we're always arguing. And most of the time when I'm talking to the scientists, we're, you know, our imaginations are on fire and we're, you know, we're zapping one another. So it's a paradox. So I think there's a third culture, and it's beyond C.P. Snow's two cultures. But I couldn't do it at MIT. I really tried, but it just wasn't possible. Now, of course, it's a different generation, and you might be able to do it at Berkeley or, you know. But certainly, I think I wouldn't advise any of you to quit the university and set up alternative institutions. I think that was something fey that was just part of my generation in the 70s, inspired by Illich and all of that. And I think it's marginalized its impact, and it's probably not a viable political thing to do. I'm glad I did it. I've had an interesting 20 years. Yes, you, madam.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, do you think an aspect of the environmental movement of an intentional primitivism and going back to direct experience in nature has, how will that inform this electronic Disney culture?
Well, you know, it was funny. First of all, I'd say it's just romanticism, and it's typical that whenever you get a new technology, the old one is put in quotes, and that's, you see the old and you don't see the new. It's like in the age of freeways and television in the 50s, what you go into when you see Disney World is a 1910 small town with clop, clop, clop horses and streetcars and soda fountains and American 1910, right as it's taking off Henry Adams style to become a world power. So that's always the paradox, that whenever you move into a new technology, you sentimentalize and create an artifact in nostalgia for nature, and you return to nature. You don't return to nature, you return to an idea of nature. So what happened in the 70s, everybody returned to nature in utopian communities, but they became very regressive and sort of got exploded because infantile dynamics of the nuclear family got projected onto the mother, mom and pop, whoever in charge of the community. And there were all kinds of psychodrama played out, whether it was The Farm and Steve Gaskin or Finn Horner, Lindisfarne or Zen Center in San Francisco. All of those got involved in kind of infantile psychodynamics, and they were regressive and neo-Neolithic. They weren't really futuristic. At the same time, they were saying, we are the evolutionary, you know, avant-garde. So I see those as fairly reactionary. Nature, I don't think really there is anything called nature. I think nature is the horizon of culture. When we say nature, we see Sierra Club, pictures, Elliot Porter, which come from Constable and Corot in Gainsborough and come from the Gentleman's Park, which gave us Olmsted Central Park in the middle of New York. That's an idea of nature. We don't think of toxic dumps in New Jersey. But I mean, if you got down to the molecular level and you danced with the electrical sound and light show of a toxic dump in New Jersey, it could be the most beautiful thing you'd ever experience. But it's not in our horizon of what we want to call natural. Or if you got out to supernovas or colliding galaxies, it would be so horrendously unnatural and terrifying that we wouldn't want to call it natural. So nature is our horizon. We like mammals better than cockroaches, things of this sort. And so when we go back to nature, we don't think of going to cockroaches in Manhattan. We think of going to the Rockies in Colorado, which is, of course, what I did. Yes, sir, you have another chance.
Define aromatic technology and any examples, like is that Lindisfarne project of the biosphere on St. John, something like that?
No, aromatic is a special thing that, it's a mythological system that Steiner's developed. It's a sort of dialectic in which the Christ is in the middle as the mediation of two opposites, the collectivization and non-individuation of Ahriman, which is a kind of demonic, devilish figure, and the exaltation of the individual to cosmic, solipsistic, autistic forms. Like in Milton's Paradise Lost, Lucifer says, one step further makes me highest. And so the notion that you can be a self escaping into ecstasy is the Luciferic dimension, and the other, where everything is Stalinistically compressed into no individuality, in the Ahrimanic. And for him, the mediation of the myth of, in Western culture, of individuation is the Christ. And he did a sculpture in Dornach, in which Ahriman and Lucifer are wrestling with the Christ. It's a whole mythological trope that Steiner has developed in his life. And there is a book called Lucifer and Ahriman, of lectures that he gave in Bern in about 1906. But basically, and he also made predictions that, I think in some of his lectures he said that Lucifer had a human incarnation in China in about the 3rd millennium BC. So in Flash Gordon, the Ming figure is really, Flash Gordon is basically Pop Steiner, you know. The way we Americans experience high Germanic mysticism is through comic books. And so if you did a cultural history of the Wizard of Oz and Flash Gordon and Superman and Captain Marvel and the Fabulous Four, which is another version of the subtle bodies, the Fantastic Four is the subtle body architecture, you could show how America took the European high culture and democratized it through the comic book and made, smuggled in through customs, mysticism in comic book form. That's part of our kind of genius, and now we do it in movies, but it has deep roots. The Wizard of Oz is just totally an esoteric allegory of individuation in the subtle bodies. At any rate, that's a long answer. So Ming is Lucifer, and he has a prediction that now, toward the year 2000, Ahriman will take a collective incarnation in America, in the New World. And so you'll find Steiner people who hate electronics, and when they raise their kids say, you can't have stereos, you shouldn't watch television, that television and stereos are evil, no computers, you know. So there, it's a intense battleground of good and evil. How are we doing for time? You should pull the plug whenever you want to. I'll go on all night, I mean, you know. 5 minutes, okay. Yes?
A couple questions. What's meta-business?
Meta-business. That's a good question. It's so good a question, I don't have a fast answer for it, which shows it's really a good question. When you say meta-business, what I tend to think of is Lawrence Rockefeller, who is this meta-businessman who's funded the whole alternative movement and created national parks and all over the country and Buddhist monasteries, and has this kind of like a Renaissance prince. He's almost like sort of the way the Medicis were to Ficino in Renaissance Florence. So that the purpose of amassing capital is not to amass capital, but to empower a civilizational vision, you know. And so ordinary business is just make a buck, quarterly report, wealth. Meta-business is empowering a vision where the amassing of capital is for another purpose. That would be a tentative answer to a... I think America's trying to figure out and embody, and the yuppie generation in the 80s were sort of mini-business, you know, and it got to be really very tight focus of wealth. And now it seems, you know, it's like the 70s were sort of flipped out, spacey, and ungrounded, and the 80s were ground and no space, you know. It was Dynasty in Dallas, and we had Star Trek. Now I hope 90s are going to be the dialectical synthesis, and we're going to get really grounded mysticism and a real politics that'll be a Gaia politique, which is what I've tried to argue for in the books. But I don't see it yet. You know, it's wishful thinking on my part.
Yeah. I have another question. I'm interested in studying Gaia politique. Now, you've said that, that there's not, from your experience, it's not one place where it's being studied, but it's in a number of places.
Yeah.
Where would you recommend a student, an upcoming student, go to? What directions?
Well, the way I've tried to, let's say, be a teacher of Gaia Politique is not to do it in a university, but to do it in the cathedral at the edge of Columbia, in the ghetto, in Spanish Harlem, in New York at 110th and Amsterdam Avenue, because that gives me a mare pattern of overlapping domains that are academic and religious and economic, so that I'm forced to deal with kind of funky things of the homeless and problems that I wouldn't have at MIT when I was a professor in St. John the Divine. And so there have been classes and what should we say, symposiums and concerts of ideas on the political implications of Gaia, for example, that we had at St. John the Divine in 1985, in which Lynn Margulis and Lovelock and all the people came and explored the political implications, and that's what that became. So that's where I do it. But there are, you know, the Eco Party. There are various groups in Berlin and in Germany, although that's gotten very fragmentary now. It's kind of spread out. I can't think of any one particular place where I could say that's where you'll find it all together. Yes, sir.
Are you going to be doing any seminars and workshops expanding on this out here at home?
No, I'm just here tonight, and I go see my family in L.A., and then I head back to New York.
Nothing in the future plans?
No, I'm getting tired of travel, so most of my teaching is at St. John the Divine, and so that's where I really hang out and give a seminar. But it's a class, you know, it's not like with grades or papers, it's just, you know, very much sort of like this, you know, except the people come for a month.
You speak about Disneyism as being a universal solvent for the planetary culture. And the minute that you postulated that, it raised the question in me, what do you posit as the universal coagulant?
No, actually I said that noise was the universal solvent of Renaissance individuality, and not so much that Disneyism is. I think the importance of the new mathematical imagination is that in the old sort of linear equations of modernism and the mathematics that came out of the Renaissance, you could have the notion of an elite, Darwin, Marx, and Freud, articulating an ideology that then would be inflicted on the mass. And so it was very much a pie-shaped kind of thing, center and periphery. You start with Marx and you end up with Stalin or whatever. I think now in the transformation of our mathematical imagination of space from Poincaré to chaos dynamics, that's no longer adequate, and that there is a reimagination of the world in music and mathematics where the solvent, what was the word, coagulant, is more a convergence of music and mathematics that in old cosmologies would be called angelic. I, for example, am totally fascinated with animism and angelology as topological forms. Yeah, that certainly, I was fascinated when I read that as a kid in high school, yeah. And certainly I've lived in Switzerland, so I've been around the sort of echoes of, you know, of Hesse and the Beat Game. But there again, he crystallized it and tried to create the elitist academy. And the actual Beat Game and the masters of the Beat Game would not be in a utopian community that was the new cloister, but would be a distributive lattice spread throughout the planet and would not be crystallized into a single elite. So that's why in a lot of the early political writings I tried to articulate separating authority from power. But that in some sense was responsible for our marginalization and why, you know, think tanks were more effective and Lindisfarne was more ineffective. But who knows, maybe in 100 years it'd be different, but we are definitely the long ways. Last one and then we'll call it a night. Yes, sir.
One thing you mentioned was you said Joseph Campbell was archaic with respect to the MTV generation. And one thing you didn't mention, or I didn't hear it, was anything about the possibility of I think, economic depression somewhere down the road. And I wondered if you considered the possibility of economic catastrophe to be out of the question, and if not, then that might be the kind of Joseph Campbell sort of crisis that would face the MTV generation in terms of making their whole technological views of
suffering as an environment. Yeah, that's a possibility, as we're all involved in a common planetary narrative. In the chapter on Disney, there is actually a discussion of the Depression and its role to Disneyism. One of the things that has blown my mind in Fernand Braudel's three-volume history of the modern world is his dynamical sense, where he said the signal of the transfer of the capital of the world economy from London to New York was the crash of 1929. And when you look at all the New York, everything, you know, you go to a New York apartment with the hexagonal tiles in the bathroom and the sinks, everything is built in the 30s. And the whole sensibility of New York is Cole Porter and the 30s, the Empire State Building, Rockefeller Center. It was all built in the Depression. New York became the capital of the world economy through the Depression. So how one interprets what is happening in a Depression, it's a catastrophe bifurcation, but it may actually be the signal of the transfer from one attractor to another, and it may be much more, quote, positive than we would tend to think of. So that those who can play the game, in the way that DuPont played the game in the Depression, they bought up all GM stock. And so a Depression is a way for getting rid of, you know, yuppies and overextended people and larger people buying up all the, you know, the playing field. So what constitutes a Depression is a really interesting question. So from 29 to 87, you had New York as the capital of the world economy. And then you had the crash of 87, which was larger in volume than 29. And it signaled the impact of program electronic trading and personal computers and the software as the way in which people were playing the game. So it couldn't be controlled or monitored in the same way. So it signaled that now the world economy was a distributive lattice between Hong Kong, Singapore, Frankfurt, and it was the scene of the action was not Wall Street anymore, and a chaotic attractor was totally unpredictable and had a new state space, which was not Wall Street but was the planet. So 87 signaled the end of New York as the capital of the world economy. Now my response to that is to say, therefore, we need to reincarnate New York. You know, the Eiffel Tower captured Paris at its time in the Great Fair, and the Empire State Building captured New York and incarnated it as the capital of the world economy. Now I'm trying to work with all these scientists and architects to reincarnate it in terms of bringing art, science, and religion together in the biosphere, resurrecting the Gothic Cathedral in a whole new post-historic sort of way as what the future of New York is supposed to be in this, you know, post-New York kind of world. But New York is very depressed. There's a hemorrhage of capital to Texas. And it just may not, you know, be able to make it. And the amount of, you know, just the fabric of the disintegration of subways, public transportation, homeless, and the rest of it, I mean, it is really, New York is already a catastrophe. You don't have to wait, you know, for the future. I mean, it's just every day.
What's happening
next? They're just getting all the money, except they're recreating L.A. They've got gridlock on Sunday for people driving to church, and they're making all the mistakes of Los Angeles in the 50s, but they have a lot of money. A lot of the corporations are going, and they're creating medieval enclosed complexes where the corporation executives and their wives, like I think American Airlines moved to Dallas, they're all enclosed in these safe neighborhoods, and they don't have to deal with New York, and so they're moving out there, but the services and the quality of life and the intellectual cultural level is, I mean, I don't want to move to Dallas. I'll hang in there with New York, you know, bad as it is. But. Okay. Thank you very much.